Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this underlying expectation of precision. It's almost like engineering in a way.
Right, it's very clinical.
Exactly. You fall off your bike, your arm is throbbing, you go to the hospital, and they put you in that cold, sterile room.
Yeah, and the X-ray machine does its comforting little mechanical hum.
Right. And a few minutes later, the doctor pulls up an image. They just point to a glowing screen, trace a jagged white line on the radius bone, and say, there it is.
It's incredibly binary, isn't it? Broken or not broken. You don't have to debate the philosophy of the bone.
Right. It's clean, you know exactly what the problem is, and you put a cast on it. But then you step out of the hospital and look at the world.
And the precision just vanishes.
It totally vanishes. You look at how our entire civilization measures its own health and its own survival. And suddenly, it feels like that economic X-ray machine we rely on is fundamentally broken.
Oh, absolutely.
We all have this creeping sensation that something is deeply fractured in our society. I mean, we see the housing crises, the ecological unraveling, the burnout. But the X-ray we get, things like the GDP or the stock market, just prints out a picture of a perfectly healthy patient.
Yeah, it tells us we've never been richer.
Exactly.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. The patient feels like they are dying, but the machines are, beeping at a very cheerful, profitable rhythm.
And that disconnect is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are sitting down with a genuinely paradigm-shifting academic white paper published in May 2026.
Yeah, and it's a heavy one.
It is. It's called Beyond the Midas Trap, a life-coherent framework for monetary financial capture and protection of the life ground. And it's authored by Dr. Bechara Saheeli.
Which is quite the title, I know.
It is. But our mission for you today is to explore a terrifying, but I think ultimately hopeful premise. The idea that our civilization might be trapped in a system that values financial abstractions more than living reality.
And more importantly, we are going to explore the architecture this paper lays out for how we can actually escape it.
Right.
But setting the baseline here is so critical because when people hear phrases like monetary financial capture, they immediately brace themselves for a lecture about how money is the root of all evil.
Oh, for sure. They think it's going to be anti-capitalist dogma.
Exactly. But this white paper isn't anti-money. I've actually set my visual backdrop today to show an evolving cityscape naturally merging into a vibrant ancient forest because that synthesis is really what the author is getting at.
That's a great visual.
Thanks. The paper is not anti-market or anti-banking or anti-wealth. Money and accounting are just powerful social instruments. They coordinate trust.
They allow complex societies to build things.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if the paper isn't against money, what is the actual trap?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. I was reading this over the weekend, and the way the author uses the King Midas metaphor really struck me. I want you, the listener, to imagine you're playing a massive, complex video game.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Yeah, so you are intensely focused on optimizing your gold score. You're watching those little golden numbers tick up net up on the top right of your screen, and you completely tune out the rest of the game mechanics.
You're just totally dialed in on the gold.
Exactly. You are a financial genius in this game. But then, right as you hit a billion gold coins, your screen goes black. You get a game over.
Because you ignored everything else.
Right. Why? Because while you were staring at the gold counter, you completely failed to realize your character's life meter hit zero. They literally starved to death while sitting on a mountain of digital gold. That is the Midas Trap.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. I mean, the original mythological curse of King Midas wasn't actually about the concept of wealth. The tragedy of Midas was twofold.
Okay, what's the first part?
Well, first, it was about a dangerous psychological condition called value monoculture.
Value monoculture.
Right. That's the desire to have a universal conversion power, where every unique, irreplaceable thing in the world is suddenly measurable by one single dead
Like
substance.
turning everything to gold.
Exactly. An ancient oak tree, a human relationship, a healthy river in the Midas trap, all of that plurality is endangered because the system only knows how to value it if it turns to gold.
Wow. And the second part of the curse.
The second part is touch without responsibility. Think about the myth. Midas touches a rose and it turns to gold. He changes the physical reality of the world through an abstract contact.
But he doesn't feel the consequences.
Right, not until he tries to smell a rose and realizes it's dead metal. In our modern economy, financial actors manage portfolios from thousands of miles away.
Yeah, they touch the world through abstractions like Futures contracts, derivatives, leveraged buyouts.
Exactly. They alter the reality of communities and ecosystems without ever having to bear the physical responsibility of that touch.
It's basically touching the world through a spreadsheet.
It really is.
And the paper lays out this incredibly clear mechanical pathway for how this actually happens. It calls it the Midas sequence.
Yes, the five-step process.
Right. It's how we convert the living world into a financialized trap. It goes life to asset, to claim, to yield, to power. Let me see if I can walk through this with a real-world example, and you correct me where I go off track.
Go for it. Let's use a natural resource.
Okay, let's take an untouched, ancient underground aquifer. That's step one, the life ground. It's just living reality. It has immense value because it sustains an entire valley's ecosystem.
Perfect.
Then step two, the aquifer gets mapped, legally enclosed, and converted into an asset. It's no longer just water in the earth. It is now a quantifiable property that can be bought and sold.
You're completely on track. The transition from life to asset is the moment of enclosure.
And then step three, that asset becomes the basis of a claim. Let's say a multinational bottling corporation buys the deed. They now have a legally enforced claim, a right to extract from that aquifer.
Right.
Step four is yield. The entire corporate apparatus organizes around extracting a recurring financial return from that claim. Like, how fast can we pump the water? How cheaply can we bottle it?
How can we maximize the quarterly dividends for our shareholders based on this water?
Exactly. And what happens to the valley?
The valley starts to dry up.
It dries up. The farmers can't irrigate. The local wells run dry. But the company's stock price is soaring. And that brings us to step five, power.
Because the corporation is generating so much yield, they use that money to lobby local politicians, fund PR campaigns, and shape the laws.
To ensure their claim is protected above all else, they use their financial power to stop the town from building public water infrastructure.
And there it is, the living reality. The actual water that people need to survive is completely subordinated to the financial claim built upon it.
That is wild.
That is the Midas sequence in a nutshell. You start with life, and you end with a self-protecting financial abstraction. The original life source is hollowed out to feed the claim.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. It reminds me of the old philosophical idea of the map replacing the territory.
Oh, that's a good connection.
Yeah, like the financial system is a map. It's meant to represent the real world, the living world, the ecology, the human beings that is the actual territory. But we've reached a point where we are driving entirely by the map.
Trusting the map blindly.
Right. If the financial map says there's a smooth, paved road ahead, like, look, GDP's up 3%. Mm-hmm. But you look at the windshield and you're driving toward a literal cliff of ecological collapse and social despair. Well, trusting the map over your own eyes is fatal.
It absolutely is.
But I have to push back a little here. I mean, isn't this just the cost of doing business in a complex society? We need accounting. We need prices and claims to coordinate building hospitals, roads, and power grids. How do we distinguish between a useful map and a fatal trap?
That's the exact friction point the paper addresses. To answer that, Dr. Cicirelli pulls in a brilliant framework from the philosopher and scholar John McMurtry.
Okay, what does McMurtry say?
McMurtry makes a vital distinction between two types of sequences. One is life value sequencing, and the other is money value sequencing. Your point about building roads and hospitals, that requires coordination, yes. But the trap closes when the ultimate goal of our coordination shifts.
Okay, so what's the difference between the two sequences?
What's fascinating here is that in a money value sequence, the formula is simply money leading to more money, M to M plus.
M plus, yeah.
Right, that is the only metric of success. Let's say a private equity firm buys a chain of veterinary clinics. They advance money, the M. Their only goal is to pull out more money, M plus, in 5 years.
So how do they do it?
They cut staff. They push expensive, unnecessary treatments on pet owners. They underpay the remaining nurses. And they sell the building to rent it back. After 5 years, they sell the hollowed out company for a massive profit.
Wow.
In the money value sequence, that is a flawless victory. The spreadsheet says they are geniuses.
Even though the actual life capacity, you know, the health of the pets and the well-being of the vets was degraded.
Yeah, precisely. Now, compare that to a life value sequence. The formula here is life leading to expanded life capacity, life to life plus.
So money is still used.
Money is still used, but it's used merely as a transitional tool. A community uses money to build a clinic, hire doctors, and purchase medicine, with the ultimate goal that the community experiences less disease and more vitality.
Got it.
If the exact same veterinary chain was run on a life value sequence, success would be measured by the health of the animals and the resilience of the community.
So the trap is that the exact same activity can look wildly successful in money value terms while being catastrophic in life value terms.
Exactly. We've automated our society to only recognize the M to M plus sequence.
So if our primary navigational tool is completely blind to life, how do we even know how much danger we are in? We need a totally different diagnostic machine.
And that is exactly what Dr. Saley provides. The paper outlines a civilizational stress test.
A stress test.
Yeah. A stress test in engineering or medicine is designed to show how a system behaves under extreme pressure. Dr. Saley evaluates our current monetary financial order by looking at 7 fundamental primitives of viability.
The 7 primitives. I have the list right here. It's constraint, margin state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options. But, you know, reading them off a list doesn't do much.
Yeah.
Let's actually dig into the mechanics of how these govern our lives.
Let's do it.
Starting with constraint. What is actually constraining us right now?
Well, in a rational, life-coherent system, our constraints would be physical and ecological. Do we have enough arable land? Do we have enough fresh water?
Right, real things.
But in the Midas track, our constraints are almost entirely artificial. They are claim system constraints. Think about fiscal rules, credit ratings, or national debt ceilings.
Ah, I see.
These are human inventions, yet governments treat them as if they are absolute laws of physics.
Right. A city council will look at a bridge that is literally rusting and crumbling, and they will say, "We simply cannot afford to fix this." The bond market will downgrade our credit rating. They treat the bond market's mood like it's gravity.
Exactly. And because we submit to these artificial financial constraints, we systematically destroy our margin. Margin is the second primitive.
Explain margin to me, because to me, margin just sounds like the blank space on a piece of paper.
In systems theory, margin is the buffer zone. It's the space between a disturbance and a total breakdown.
Okay. Give me an example.
For a household, margin is having 6 months of savings and a community of friends you can rely on. For an ecosystem, margin is biodiversity.
Gotcha.
The Midas trap systematically eats away at margin because it views any idle buffer as an inefficiency that could be financialized. A household's margin, their time and income, is entirely consumed by rent, student loans, and credit card interest. The system extracts until the household is living paycheck to paycheck.
I used an analogy in my notes for this. It's like a trucking company trying to optimize its profits by running a massive diesel engine without any oil to save money on maintenance.
Oh, that's good.
The oil is the margin. The financial dashboard says, "Wow, we cut costs by 10%. We are highly efficient." And that's technically true right up until the friction causes the engine blocks to literally seize, melt down, and explode on the highway.
That is a brilliant analogy, and it leads perfectly into the 3rd and 4th primitives, state and disturbance.
Okay, let's hear it.
The paper describes the current everyday state of our civilization as managed depletion under financialized stability.
Managed depletion.
Yes. On paper, the banks are passing their stress tests, the stock markets are liquid, and the GDP is ticking up. But beneath that very thin veneer of stability, the engine is running without oil.
Households are debt-stressed, topsoil is eroding, mental health is plummeting.
Exactly. It is managed depletion.
And disturbance is the event that strips away the veneer.
Yes. A disturbance is a shock, like a global pandemic, a sudden climate disaster, or a massive market crash. The disturbance doesn't create the fragility. It merely reveals the hidden lack of margin.
Right.
But more importantly, the disturbance reveals the system's hidden hierarchy of rescue.
Let's pause there, because this part of the paper made me furious.
I don't blame you.
The hierarchy of rescue. I mean, we saw this so clearly during the 2008 financial crisis, and again during the pandemic. In ordinary, peaceful times, society pretends that we balance everything equally. We care about public health, we care about the environment, and we care about the economy.
But when a massive disturbance hits,
the mast drops.
The mast absolutely drops. When a major banking system is on the brink of failure, when the claims system is threatened, trillions of dollars are quite literally summoned out of thin air over a single weekend.
It's incredible how fast it happens.
Central banks open endless liquidity facilities. Rules are rewritten. Emergency sessions of Congress are held. The rescue is immediate, limitless, and unconditional.
But when human beings face a crisis, when millions are facing eviction, or when an entire region is devastated by a hurricane, or when we are told we need a rapid transition away from fossil fuels to prevent ecological collapse, suddenly, the limitless checkbook disappears.
The language completely changes. When human life is on the line, policymakers suddenly remember their artificial constraints. The vocabulary shrinks to words like affordability, targeting, fiscal discipline, and my personal favorite, moral hazard.
Oh, moral hazard.
Right. We are told we can't just give people homes because it would create moral hazard. But bailing out a bank that made reckless derivatives bets apparently doesn't.
The asymmetrical rescue proves what the system actually worships. It will sacrifice the life ground to save the financial claim. I want to ask you, the listener, to really think about this for a second. Have you ever noticed how quickly the talking heads on television mobilize to defend a plunging stock market, demanding government intervention?
Oh, constantly.
But the exact same people will look at underfunded public schools in your neighborhood and say, well, the money just isn't there. We have to tighten our belts. It's not a glitch. It is the exact design of the trap.
Which brings us to the fifth and sixth primitives, perception and regulation. This asymmetrical rescue is tolerated by the public because our perception has been fundamentally distorted.
How so?
Our economic indicators, our dashboards, they render financial data in 4K high definition. We track the Dow Jones by the minute. But the same dashboard renders care depletion, ecological unraveling, and social despair totally invisible.
Right.
And because our perception is skewed, our regulation is backward.
Backward how?
Yeah.
Don't we regulate banks to keep us safe?
We regulate banks to ensure they are safe. Most financial regulation is designed to protect finance from the volatility of life rather than protecting life from the extractive nature of finance.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
We have endless regulations ensuring banks hold enough capital against their loans so they don't go bankrupt. But we have virtually no regulations ensuring that the loans they make aren't actively destroying communities or driving climate collapse.
Which locks us into the final primitive, options. The ultimate triumph of the latest trap is that it shrinks our civilizational imagination.
Exactly. Any alternative to this highly financialized extractive realism is immediately dismissed as utopian, childish, or mathematically impossible.
We are trapped by a fused vocabulary. We use words interchangeably that actually mean completely opposite things. And the only way to generate new options is to decouple that language.
Which takes us right into the heart of the paper's argument. If we want to escape, we have to stop speaking the language of the trap.
The paper says there are 12 vital distinctions we must make. We don't have time to cover all 12, but we need to zero in on the heavy hitters. Let's start with the most basic one. Money is not wealth, and growth is not flourishing.
We touched on this with the M to M plus sequence, but we need to go deeper. What is wealth, actually?
Good question.
Wealth is the tangible abundance of life capacity. It is having clean water, safe shelter, robust topsoil, loving relationships, and meaningful work. Money is none of those things.
Money is just a sign.
Right. It is a legal convention, a ticket, a coordination device. The trap survives by confusing the ticket to the concert with the music itself.
And that leads to the growth illusion.
Right. We celebrate GDP growth as if it is synonymous with human flourishing. But GDP is just a measure of total monetary transactions. An economy can grow massively through war, mass incarceration, chronic illness, and environmental disasters.
I always think of this like a household budget. Imagine you are celebrating because your family is spending 40% more money this year than last year. Your personal GDP is skyrocketing.
Right.
But if you look at the ledger, all that extra spending is going toward chemotherapy for your spouse, lawyers for a divorce, and repairing your house after a flood. The money value is growing, but your life capacity is completely crashing.
You are not flourishing.
Exactly. Yet when a nation does this, economists pop champagne.
That is a hauntingly accurate way to put it. Now let's look at another massive distinction the paper makes. And this one relies heavily on the work of the economist Michael Hetzen. Rent is not productive contribution.
I want to spend some real time on this because when people hear rent, they just think of the check they write to their landlord on the first of the month.
Mm-hmm.
But Michael Hetzen is talking about something much more systemic, right?
Much more systemic. To understand this, we have to look at classical economics. A productive contribution is an activity that creates, repairs, or coordinates life capacity.
Like a farmer growing food, or a nurse healing a patient, an engineer building a bridge.
Yes, they are adding actual value to the world. Rent, in the economic sense, is income derived purely from control over access. It is a toll booth.
Okay, walk me through the toll booth.
Imagine a beautiful paved road that connects a town to a river. The townspeople built it together. It's productive. Now imagine someone comes along, buys the deed to the land the road sits on, and sets up a gate. They didn't build the road. They don't maintain the road. They just stand there and demand $5 from anyone who wants to walk to the river. That $5 is economic rent. Hudson argues that our modern economy has devolved into a neo-feudal system where the many must pay tolls to the few just to exist.
So it's not just housing rent. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. Mm. You pay rent to dwell. You pay interest, which is just rent on money to borrow for an education. You pay monopoly patent rents to get life-saving medicine. You pay platform fees to tech giants just to communicate with your customers.
Man, the rentier did not create the life need. They just enclosed it and put a gate around it.
Exactly. The problem is that our GDP metrics classify rent as productive income. We treat the toll booth operator as if they are the most productive member of society simply because they extract the most money. It makes the economy morally illegible.
That perfectly bridges to another major distinction that always breaks my brain. Corporate personhood is not living personhood.
This is a profound legal asymmetry. A corporation is a legal fiction. It is a very useful tool, historically speaking, for organizing enterprise and pooling capital. But a corporation does not breathe.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a nervous system. It cannot feel pain. It cannot grieve. And it doesn't leave behind children who have to live on a burning planet.
Wait, I know legally they are considered persons for things like contracts, but how does that actually enforce the Midas trap?
Through the shield of limited liability. If a corporation makes a decision that dumps toxic waste into a river, the corporation might pay a fine. But the actual human beings who made the decision, the executives and the shareholders, are legally shielded from the personal embodied consequences of their actions.
They get to extract the upside, the yield, while the living ecosystems and actual human beings in that community absorb all the downside.
We have built a legal architecture where the immortal, unfeeling legal fiction is granted stronger protections than the living, breathing beings affected by it.
Which brings me to this distinction that I think might be the most counterintuitive for our listeners. Financial stability versus life stability.
This is a big one.
Before reading this paper, I would have assumed those were the exact same thing. If the stock market is hitting all-time highs, doesn't that mean our lives are more stable? But Dr. Seeley says that financial stability built on life instability isn't a paradox. It's just delayed collapse.
Think about what conventional financial stability actually measures. The Federal Reserve looks at whether banks are well-capitalized and if the payment systems are clearing. As long as the financial claims are secure, they declare the system stable.
But life coherent stability asks a completely different set of questions.
Right. Are households secure in their dwellings? Are the soils regenerating? Is community trust intact?
The paper specifically points out the horror of asset inflation here.
Yes, and housing is the perfect example. Politicians and financial pundits constantly celebrate rising real estate values. Home prices are up 10% this year. The market is strong.
They sell asset inflation as prosperity.
But what does that actually mean in reality? It means the price of shelter is rising, which means access to shelter is falling. The financial asset is growing, but the actual life function of the home, to provide secure, affordable sanctuary for a family, is being destroyed. We are cheering for our own exclusion.
My mind is completely reeling. If the system is built on these hidden mechanisms, if we are calling extraction, production, and exclusion prosperity, then we can't just look at the surface. We have to look under the hood.
We absolutely do.
We have to figure out how the engine is actually built. Who is making this money? Who is deciding who gets it? This takes us into the deepest part of the paper, where Dr. Seeley brings in some incredibly heavy-hitting economic theories as diagnostic instruments. We need to talk about Richard Werner.
Yes. Richard Werner's empirical work is an absolute bombshell, and it's something that completely shatters the reality of most people who learn it for the first time.
Let's set the table here. What is the textbook story of banking that you and I and everyone listening were taught in high school economics?
The textbook story is that banks are simply intermediaries. They are middlemen. The story goes, a bunch of frugal people save their money and deposit it into the bank.
Right.
Then an entrepreneur comes along who needs a loan to start a bakery.
Right.
The bank takes the saver's money from the vault and lends it to the entrepreneur. The bank just moves existing money from point A to point B.
And Richard Werner says,
Werner's research, which, by the way, has been explicitly confirmed by the Bank of England and the Bundesbank, proves that this textbook story is completely, fundamentally false. Commercial banks do not lend out pre-existing deposits.
I really want the listener to stop whatever they are doing and hear this. If they aren't lending out deposits, what are they doing?
They are literally creating money out of nothing.
Wait, Really?
Yes. When you go into a bank to get a $500,000 mortgage to buy a house, the bank does not check to see if they have $500,000 of other people's savings in the vault.
They don't.
No. You sit at the desk, you sign a promissory note, which is your legal pledge to pay them back with interest, and the banker simply types $500,000 into your account on a computer. That money did not exist seconds before.
That is insane.
Through the magic of double-entry bookkeeping, the bank creates a new asset, your debt to them, and a new liability, the numbers in your account. They just minted brand new purchasing power.
So private for-profit banks are the ones actually printing the vast majority of the money supply in our economy, not the government.
Exactly. Upwards of 90% of the money circulating in the economy today is credit created by private banks. And this leads to Verner's quantity theory of credit. Because banks have this godlike power, credit allocation isn't just a boring financial transaction. It is literal world-making.
Because whoever creates the money gets to decide what future we build.
Precisely. If a bank decides to type new money into existence to fund regenerative agriculture or high-speed rail or public health infrastructure, that money creates real productive life capacity.
But banks are for-profit institutions.
Right. They want the highest yield with the lowest risk. So where do they actually direct the credit?
They direct it into existing assets. They create millions of dollars to fund speculative housing purchases, corporate mergers, and leveraged buyouts.
So they are pumping new money into a fixed supply of houses, which is exactly why the asset inflation we just talked about happens.
Yes. And that leads directly into the work of another scholar cited in the paper, Steve Keen. Keen builds on the legendary economist Hyman Minsky to show what happens when banks create all this endogenous money.
Endogenous money, meaning money created from within the banking system.
Exactly. When banks create money, they also simultaneously create massive private debt.
Walk me through how this creates a bubble. Let's use a localized example.
Imagine a small town with 100 houses. Everyone is doing fine. Then a bank comes in and starts creating massive amounts of credit out of thin air, offering everyone cheap mortgages to buy second and third homes as investments.
Okay, I see where this is going. Suddenly, there is a flood of new money chasing the exact same 100 houses. Prices skyrocket. Everyone in town feels incredibly rich because their online home estimate doubled. They borrow against their home equity to buy boats and cars. This is the fragile pseudo-prosperity.
But the actual life capacity of the town hasn't changed. There are still just 100 houses.
Right. And eventually the math catches up. The sheer volume of private debt outpaces the actual life capacity and income of the town. People can't make the interest payments.
The bubble bursts.
The bubble bursts, the bank forecloses on the homes, and the town is plunged into a depression. The living world is forced to endure brutal austerity to pay back claims on money that the bank literally typed into existence.
Which brings in a concept from scholar Ivo Mosley, the Democratic scandal. If the public doesn't understand this process, if the average voter thinks the government creates the money and the banks just move it around, then democracy is basically a sideshow.
It is entirely downstream of hidden financial power. We spend months agonizing and debating over minor adjustments to the tax code while completely ignoring the fact that a handful of private institutions are privately dictating the world-making power of credit creation.
We have outsourced the steering wheel of our civilization to private entities whose only legal mandate is M to M plus. They have no mandate to protect the road, the passengers, or the destination.
Exactly.
So wait, if private banks are creating the money supply, how does that connect to the way politicians always talk about government spending? You turn on the news and every pundit is yelling, the national debt is too high. We have to balance the federal budget like a family balances its checkbook. We can't afford to keep the libraries open.
That is perhaps the most insidious linguistic trap of all. And to dismantle it, Dr. Saley incorporates modern monetary theory, or MMT.
MMT, right.
The core insight of MMT here is that the household analogy is a dangerous, violent myth when applied to a monetarily sovereign government.
Break that down. Why is a government not like a household?
A household is a currency user. You and I have to obtain money by working or borrowing before we can spend it. If I don't have dollars in my bank account, I can't buy groceries.
True.
But a monetarily sovereign government like the U.S., the U.K., or Japan is a currency issuer. They do not need to collect taxes first in order to spend. They create the currency. Therefore, the true limits on what a government can do are never financial.
If the limit isn't money, what is it?
Real resources. Labor, steel, concrete, energy, and ecological capacity. Imagine a city that has been hit by an earthquake. There are bricks sitting in a warehouse. There are unemployed construction workers sitting at home. There are homeless citizens needing shelter.
So all the real physical resources to rebuild the city exist?
Yes. But the mayor stands up and says, we cannot rebuild the houses because we don't have enough numbers in the city's spreadsheet.
That is absolute madness. The town stays paralyzed because of an accounting fiction.
Exactly. When a government says there is no money to fund healthcare or clean water or ecological repair, they are not describing a physical reality. They are describing a political choice to enforce artificial scarcity.
Wow.
MMT shows us that austerity, the political choice to cut public services to balance a budget, is not responsible accounting. It is often what the sociologist Johann Gultum calls structural violence.
Structural violence. In plain English, what does that mean?
It means violence that isn't committed with a weapon, but is built into the structure of society. If a policy choice predictably results in children going hungry or preventable deaths from lack of medicine, and that policy was chosen simply to protect the stability of financial claims, that is violence disguised as fiscal necessity.
Okay, I need to take a breath here. Because if everything we've just talked about is true, if the system is actively generating this structural violence through hidden money creation and false austerity, then we can't just politely ask the system to change.
No, you really can't.
We can't just slap a tiny new consumer protection regulation on a bank and call it a day. We have to actively stop the machine. This brings us to the fifth major pivot of the paper, de-implementing the generators of capture.
De-implementation is such a crucial concept. It means withdrawing our institutional and legal support from the patterns that degrade life. You can't just build alternatives. You have to actively dismantle the extractive engines.
The paper identifies several specific generators we have to de-implement. Let's look at the first one, debt peonage. I understand debt, but what makes it peonage?
Debt itself is a neutral tool. If you take on debt to build a solar farm that provides energy for 30 years, that is generative. Debt peonage is predatory lending that feeds entirely on human vulnerability and impaired bargaining power. It captures a person's future time, labor, and dignity simply to serve as a claim.
Like someone taking out payday loans with 400% interest just to buy groceries. Right. Or medical debt. I mean, in what rational society does getting cancer mean you owe a private equity firm a portion of your income for the rest of your life?
Exactly. Or 18-year-olds taking on non-dischargeable student loans just to access the basic credentials needed to survive in the job market. De-implementing this means legally classifying predatory, life-degrading loans as illegitimate and unenforceable.
The second generator of the paper list is huge. Fossil finance lock-in.
This is critical for understanding why the climate transition is so agonizingly slow. We treat fossil fuels like they are just an energy source, and we think transitioning to renewables is just a matter of swapping out the technology.
But it's not.
No, fossil fuels are the ultimate collateral backing the global financial system. The entire petrodollar infrastructure, intertwined oil flows, sovereign wealth funds, and U.S. Treasury markets.
So telling fossil fuel companies to leave the oil in the ground isn't just an ecological mandate, it's a financial threat.
It is an existential threat to the claim system. Trillions of dollars in expected future revenues, pension fund holdings, and corporate valuations are mathematically dependent on burning that carbon. If we declare those reserves unburnable to save the planet, those financial assets become stranded. They go to zero. So the financial system fiercely resists climate repair because climate repair destroys its yield. We have to structurally decouple our financial security from carbon extraction.
But the generator that absolutely blew my mind was algorithmic attention extraction.
Yeah, that one hits close to home.
It's the financialization of human consciousness itself.
Mm.
I was reading this and I immediately thought of the movie The Matrix, where the machines are farming human bodies for heat.
You are getting very warm with that analogy, but it's actually more insidious than The Matrix. In The Matrix, they just wanted your body heat while your mind lived in a simulation. In our reality, the machines don't want your heat. They want your behavioral surplus.
Your behavioral surplus.
Yes. They are harvesting your anxiety, your outrage, and your social comparisons.
Right. The algorithm on your social media feed knows that a video that makes you furious will keep your eyes on the screen for 3 seconds longer than a video that makes you calm.
And those 3 seconds of retained attention are a monetizable asset. They are sold to advertisers. This is the Midas trap entering our interior lives.
That's terrifying.
The problem is that democratic self-governance relies on the life ground of shared attention, trust, and a baseline of shared reality, a society that is algorithmically trained to exist in a state of perpetual outrage and tribal fragmentation, cannot deliberate wisely.
So how do we de-implement that?
De-implementing this generator means treating algorithmic attention capture not as a free speech issue, but as a public health and environmental issue. We have to strictly regulate surveillance advertising and enforce algorithmic transparency.
But let me play devil's advocate here. De-implementation sounds great. Cut out the rot. But how do you actually execute this when you are up against bad faith actors? I mean, the people profiting from debt peonage, fossil fuels, and attention extraction have immense wealth. They will use armies of lobbyists, PR firms, and complex legal structures to fight this tooth and nail.
That is the most difficult hurdle, and the paper brings in a fascinating lens to view this through. Ken Wilber's concept of developmental arrest.
What does that mean in this context?
It means we have highly advanced, mathematically sophisticated, godlike technical systems, but they are governed by morally immature institutions.
Oh, that makes sense.
We have artificial intelligence and algorithmic global finance, but they are driven by the most primitive human urges for accumulation, territorial domination, and zero-sum competition. You cannot just appeal to the morality of a morally arrested system.
So what is the actual strategy against them?
The paper outlines a pragmatic four-step engagement. First, trace the flows. Bad faith thrives in abstraction, offshore accounts, and complex shell companies. You have to relentlessly follow the money, the lobbying, and the ownership structures to make them publicly visible.
Follow the money. Okay, what's step two?
Second, remove the moral cover. We have to stop using their fused vocabulary. Stop calling ecological extraction economic development. Stop calling debt peonage personal responsibility.
Call it what it is, a toll booth.
Yes. Third, change the payoffs. As long as destroying the life ground is profitable and legal, they will do it. You have to internalize the externalities. Make harm financially and legally disastrous for the decision makers.
And fourth,
build replacement vessels.
I latch onto that last point so hard. Replacement vessels. It's like the old Buckminster Fuller quote. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. You build a new model that makes the old model obsolete.
Exactly.
You can't just tear down the old corrupted house without building a new one for people to live in. If we de-implement the bad, we have to implement the good. And this leads us directly to the final and most hopeful architecture of the paper, the 10 pillars of life-coherent financial stability.
This is where Dr. Safley shifts from diagnosis to treatment. We are moving from a system of claim sovereignty to a system of life capacity.
Let's hit the most critical pillars of these 10, because they paint a picture of a radically better world. Pillars 1 and 2 are monetary transparency and credit for life capacity. We talked about how private banks create money. How do we fix that?
Pillar 1 demands absolute public legibility. The average citizen must be educated on how money is created and allocated. It can no longer be a hidden priestly knowledge.
Right.
Pillar 2 takes the power of credit creation and guides it toward actual life needs. If we know we can create money to fund the future, we should mandate that this credit is channeled into affordable housing, renewable energy, and health infrastructure, not into leveraged buyouts.
This requires robust public banking systems, right?
Exactly. And community credit unions whose legal mandate is the public good, not private shareholder yield.
Okay, pillars 3 and 4 deal with the toll booths and the debt traps. Derenturization and debt relief.
Derenturization is about restoring the margin to the household. It means aggressive anti-monopoly enforcement. It means putting limits on speculative housing ownership by Wall Street firms.
Dismantling the toll booths.
Yes. It involves implementing land value taxation to stop speculators from extracting wealth simply by sitting on idle land while the community builds around them.
And pillar 4 is establishing Jubilee pathways. Now, when some people hear cancel debt, they panic. They say, won't that destroy the economy? People signed a contract.
Here we rely on the historical wisdom of people like David Graeber and Michael Hudson. Ancient civilizations understood that compound interest grows exponentially, but the physical economy only grows organically.
Right, they grow at different speeds.
Eventually, the debt will always outpace the ability to pay. When debts destroy life capacity, when an entire generation cannot afford to have children because of student loans and housing debt, that debt is illegitimate.
So it has to be wiped out.
It must be restructured, written down, or canceled entirely in a jubilee. The economy doesn't collapse. The life ground is liberated to actually function again.
That is incredibly powerful. Now let's look at pillar 6 and 7, civil commons financing and monetary diversity. I am obsessed with the concept of monetary diversity. The paper cites the brilliant monetary architect Bernard Leder here.
Leder's insight is profound. We operate in a monetary monoculture. The only tool we have is the national fiat currency. And because of that, every single problem looks like a lack of dollars.
Right. I think about a struggling post-industrial town. You have hungry people. You have empty, overgrown lots. You have unemployed carpenters and farmers. The real physical resources to fix the town's problems are all sitting right there.
Yeah.
But the town council says, we can't do anything. There are no U.S. dollars.
Which is where a complementary currency comes in. A time bank or a mutual credit system is a locally issued currency designed specifically to connect unused capacities with unmet needs.
Wow.
It bypasses the artificial scarcity of the dominant bank-created money. It acts like a spark plug in an engine. It doesn't replace the national currency, but it operates alongside it to facilitate local care and production.
It creates resilience, much like biodiversity in an ecosystem. If a disease wipes out one crop, the forest survives. If a financial crash wipes out Wall Street liquidity, a town with a strong mutual credit system can still feed its people.
Exactly. And the civil commons, which includes things like healthcare, education, clean water, and public parks, must be funded as fundamental life support infrastructure. It must be protected from both market enclosure, privatization, and bureaucratic neglect.
We have to mention Pillar 9 before we wrap up. Rights of nature and future generations.
This might be the most philosophically profound shift. We talked earlier about how the Midas trap persists because corporations, legal fictions, have stronger standing in court than a living ecosystem.
Right.
Pillar 9 reverses that. We need legal frameworks where rivers, forests, and entire biomes have intrinsic, legally enforceable rights to exist and regenerate. Furthermore, future generations, the children who aren't born yet but will inherit our climate, must have institutional representation in our current financial decisions.
So the living territory has legal protection before the financial claims built on it.
Exactly. The living territory must have legal protection prior to the financial claims built upon it.
Okay. Looking at all these pillars together, public banking, debt jubilees, stripping away rentiers, complementary currencies, giving legal rights to a forest, I have to ask the skeptic's ultimate question.
Go for it.
The people listening to this are probably thinking, this sounds amazing, but is this actually realistic? Or is Dr. Sahili just sketching out a beautiful utopian dream?
Let's pause there, because we need to completely redefine what the word realism means. The dominant financial discourse will tell you that giving rights to a forest is unrealistic. They will say that if a policy upsets the bond market or slows down GDP growth, it is unrealistic.
Right, that's always the argument.
But that is not realism. That is just obedience to financial power.
So what is true realism?
True realism asks what is physically, biologically, and ecologically viable. Pretending that we can have infinite exponential financial growth on a finite planet, pretending that we can endlessly degrade the soils, acidify the oceans, and burn out human beings without the entire system collapsing, that is the utopian dream.
A dark utopian dream.
It is a mass suicidal delusion. The 10 pillars outlined in this paper aren't some far-off fantasy. They are the only mathematically and ecologically viable path forward. The highest realism is viability.
Wow. Just wow. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the ancient myth of King Midas, a man who turned his own daughter into gold because he was completely unable to distinguish abstract wealth from living, breathing reality.
The ultimate cautionary tale.
And we traced that exact same tragic curse through our modern housing markets, our national debts, our GDP metrics, and even the algorithms that keep our kids addicted to their screens.
We covered a lot.
We unpacked the hidden machinery. How private banks literally create money out of thin air, how false scarcity starves our communities, and how the system rapidly rescues balance sheets while letting the actual planet burn. But we didn't just diagnose the disease, we look at the cure.
Transparency, debt relief, dismantling the toll booths.
And restoring money to its proper, humble place as a servant to the life ground.
The great civilizational transition we are facing is moving from stabilizing financial claims to stabilizing life. Finance must serve life. Not the other way around.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over as you go about your day. We spent this time talking about how accounting shapes our reality. So if our society's ultimate accounting ledger completely ignores the health of our soils, the mental well-being of our kids, and the depth of our community trust, What are we actually saving up for?
That is the real question.
Who are we trying to impress with our high score? The next time you hear a politician or a pundit on television say that a social good is unaffordable, I want you to ask yourself a question. Is there a lack of actual physical resources, labor, materials, land, compassion, or is there just a lack of numbers in a spreadsheet?
And who actually has the power to change those numbers?
Exactly. Like that medical x-ray we talked about at the very beginning, the image we're constantly being shown by the financial media is missing the most vital organs. It's up to us to demand a better machine.
That is the perfect note to end on. The first democratic task of a life-coherent civilization is to demand monetary transparency in our own lives, in our own towns, and in our own nations. Until we understand who creates the money and who bears the physical costs, we remain trapped in the sequence.
Thank you for joining us on this incredibly important deep dive into Beyond the Midas Trap. Keep questioning the map you've been handed, keep looking at the real territory in front of you, and take care of the life ground around you.